Well, he calls it the biggest news story of the century, Michael Klarfeld. He says that there is historical and scientific facts proving that mankind was created by genetic engineering technology nearly a quarter of a million years ago. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with our guest, Marshall Klarfeld. I'm going to do something a little different right now. I'm going to have our guest, Marshall Klarfeld, explain a little bit about who he is, because this story that you're about to hear tonight is absolutely incredible. If you are into historical facts about mankind, the origins, some things that you hear in the Bible, the work of Zechariah Sitchin, this night is for you, our guest, Marshall Klarfeld. Hi, Marshall. How are you?
Fine, George.
Good to have you on the program. Tell us a little bit about you, Marshall.
Okay, I'm a graduate mechanical engineer from Caltech, Pasadena. I spent 4 years there with some pretty high-powered professors. Went on to do a 30-year career thing in the corporate world. And then came back to what was my real passion, is to understanding where we came from. One of the interesting things, George, about when I was there, I actually entered Caltech in 1947. That kind of dates me. But
a long time ago, Marshall.
Guess what just happened in 1947?
Roswell, New Mexico. That's right.
Right, right. And things were interesting because the UFO became part of the language at that time. It was, something new to all of us, and I had the opportunity to ask my physics professor, who was Richard Feynman, and some people thought of him as the smartest man in the world. I asked him if he believed in UFOs, and I think I'm the only one who ever did that.
And his answer was?
He told me, he said, Klarfeld, this is quoted from the book, he said, I believe in the law of probability. He said, there are 100 billion stars in the galaxy of ours, the Milky Way, and there's hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe. And the law of probability states that there are 10,000 solar systems exactly like ours in that number. And he says that if all of them were older than our star, and if any of the civilizations that existed on those systems survived their space age, they could have visited us. And then he said, yes, I believe in UFOs. And now at the time, that was kind of an interesting answer for me, George, but it's come to become more significant as I got into this research project of mine.
You know, Marshall, tonight I was watching Larry King, and he had a special on UFOs. And the guests who were on his program have been guests on Coast to Coast. Art Bell and I have interviewed them before. It's kind of nice, though, to take a perspective where you can sit down and watch them being interviewed, talking with someone else, because you get a different perspective sometimes.
Right.
And, you know, I've always come away with this thought, as some of them did on that program tonight, and they've talked about on this show before, that, you know, with Earth being in the solar system 4.5 billion years old, and the universe being about 14 billion years old, there's, you know, a 9.5 billion year jump start for someone. And even though there's an evolution of a star system that takes time to develop, there are systems out there that are billions of years older than this planet.
That's for sure.
And I would assume it's part of that thought that got you thinking in the direction that allowed you, for example, to write Adam the Missing Link?
Yes, yes. And you know, I just saw a movie by a guy named Timothy Ferris.
Yeah.
He's a physics professor up at Berkeley, and it's called Life Beyond Earth. And, George, the interesting thing was that he interviewed about 6 or 7 men and women of science, every one of which said there's life out there, and we're trying to make contact with it. We're listening. We're doing all these millions of dollars worth of projects to try to make contact. And none of them ever thought or expressly thought that they've been here already.
Exactly. And one of the reasons for that, Marshall, is they think, as brilliant as their minds are, that they're thinking in conventional methods of propulsion. And very few of them, Dr. Michio Kaku, a physicist who comes on the program a lot, right. I mean, he thinks out of the box, but not a lot of them do. And the way I look at it is yes, there are civilizations out there, probably millions of them, but in order for them to get here, and I think they have, they've yes. done it in a way we haven't even understood yet.
You're absolutely right, George, and I think that's thinking outside the box. Conventionality has always kind of constrained the scientific thinking, and they're afraid because of the peer pressure to make a statement outside the box.
Absolutely. So as you began to evolve in your own thought pattern about this, what kept leading you to some historical and scientific facts about the human race? Because you even talk about Gilgamesh. You go into all this, which fascinates me.
Well, yeah, the way I approached it, being an engineer, I kind of like to organize things into pockets and boxes. And so I looked at what are the four things that I could use as a yardstick, and I call them stored information. I don't know if you saw that page in the book.
Yes.
Stored information. There's four stored information devices. One is the text, which are the cuneiform tablets. Those are the written things.
Mm-hmm.
So I call those SITs, stored information text. Then we have the cylinder seals, which are device, which you pat wet clay on the table, and you roll this cylinder seal onto the wet clay, and you get a picture story. So I call those SIDs, stored information devices. And from that, we can learn things. And we can learn things also from the sculptures, which are stored information sculptures, and from the structures, like the pyramids, the stored information structures.
Some of these cylinder seals are remarkable when you look at them.
Incredible. I've discovered some new ones lately, and I put on the story of Gilgamesh, when we get into the DNA part of the story, I found a seal that showed Gilgamesh and his clone, which was Enkidu, holding a staff, which is exactly a DNA representation.
Jeez. It is something. You have looked at the work of Zechariah Sitchin, right?
Yes, I certainly
what do
have.
You think?
I've read all of his books.
Okay.
And I know him. I've talked to him many times. We discuss various things together.
A great historian, up in age, not very healthy.
No, he's in his late 80s, I think. And
what a mind, though. What a mind.
But I'll tell you, his works, starting in 1976 with the first book, The 12th Planet,
mm-hmm.
and the nine books that he produced since then, plus the many, many articles that appear on his webpage, is a brilliant contribution to a dialogue that I think needs to continue. You know, we need to carry his work further forward, and I think I've done that in my book. I've taken much of what he presented and then expanded on it. And you know, George, there's a thing that happened to me when I was in Chicago years ago. There's a guy named Mortimer Adler. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but he produced what's called The Great Books of the Western World. And he described it as a dialogue on ideas starting with Aristotle. In other words, each succeeding generation took the ideas of the previous generation, contributed to it, and
right.
carried the dialogue forward.
And let that build and build and build.
Yes, and it's still going on, and that's what I feel. Sitchin has really established a paradigm that is, I believe, true. And one of the reasons I can say that is that I tested it. In other words, I didn't take it verbatim as the truth. I said, I'm going to sit down and see if I can prove that what he's saying is true. And that's the sum total of the book. The book is a living proof.
Do you even take a perspective, Marshall, in the book, Adam the Missing Link, by just pondering what the heck is the universe? What are we doing here?
Well, sort of. I mean, there are some dialogues that Sitchin translated from the Lost Book of Enki, in which he talks, or he gives the translation of the two brothers who were the leaders of the Anunnaki, and they had just had this great calamity. You know, they created an atomic war that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting looking at the ruins, and they're philosophizing, well, yeah, we did what we did, and did you did what you did, and, you know. And then they talk about destiny, that, you know, the evil wind, they should have known that their weapons would have caused a fallout that would have destroyed. And actually, that's how Sumer was destroyed. The civilization.
Sure. And you're right. I mean, if they had nuclear weapons then, they were obviously aware of the fallout dangers.
Sure, sure. But they seem to justify what they do by a strange, combination of destiny and fate. They say that fate is something they can do that will maybe change the future, but destiny is something you cannot change. And I came to believe that, for instance, this planet that we're on is going to orbit the sun until the sun goes supernova, which is about 5 billion years from now. And our destiny is to be consumed by the sun. We can't avoid that.
We can't avoid that. That's true.
This home that we have now.
But we've got a long ride, don't we?
Yeah, but we also have an opportunity to go find a new home.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think we're evolving intellectually and scientifically. And, you know, if you look at the whole history of Homo sapiens, which is only 250,000 years, rougher, give or take, we came from that point and have walked on the moon. There hasn't been a species on this planet that ever evolved in that rapid fashion. In fact, there's real questions about, you know, how could that be? When for instance, the predecessor was Homo erectus, who had 1,800,000 years at evolution and never got beyond Stone Age tools and couldn't even speak.
Yeah, something happened. Now, Marshall, for all this to come together, and there's a chronology here that you illustrate, you have to go back using, let's say, the Bible, for example, as a text to this.
Yes.
You have to go back. Some of it's interpretation, no doubt.
Yes.
But when you read the book of Genesis, you can interpret it a number of different ways. I mean, people who are pure spiritualists will read that, and they'll talk about heaven and angels, fallen angels and things. Other people who have a little bit more of a scientific mind might conclude, something happened here. We were visited. How do you look at that?
That's a good question, George, because that's exactly what got me started in the beginning back at Caltech. The reason I was asking Feynman if he believed in UFOs, and I even asked my chemistry professor, Linus Pauling, if he believed in God. You know, I was a young man in his 20s searching for answers. And in reading Genesis at that time, I saw a bit of scientific knowledge that kind of fit with what I was learning at school. In other words, they were teaching us how solar systems are formed. And in that process, it's late in the process that the star ignites. If it's going to become a successful solar system and have a sun or a star, it doesn't happen to go thermonuclear until late in the process of creation. And in the Bible, I see, you know, Genesis says, and God on the fourth day created the greater light of the day and the lesser light of the night, which was out of a six-day creation mm-hmm. period. Late. Four is late in the sixth period of creation. So my interpretation, not from a religious point of view, but from a strictly, hey, I'm learning this stuff at school,
right,
and how do I see this? Where is this coming from? How did those dudes 5,000 years ago know that's how things happened? And that really got me going on it.
Well, and you wonder, how did they know? Who told them? How was it told to them?
Right.
Why was it told to them?
Well, you know, the cuneiform tablet chronology, the history that's in there, there were libraries that we found that give vast amounts of information that predated the Bible by 2,000 years. And I have a feeling that, you know, somewhere in the mix of that, the information that was handed down by the advanced civilization, the Anunnaki, told them things. They did this technology transfer that I spoke about in my SIDs, SITs, et cetera. That's a way that when an advanced civilization encounters a primitive civilization, that happens. There's technological transfers.
All right, let's go back to your theory for a moment, because I want to back into it with the rest of the program as we talk about these fascinating things that have been going on around this planet. But what is your theory about all of this, Marshall?
The theory is that I've connected the dots of what I've learned from Sitchin's research and what I've gone around and done in my own research on things that are physically exist here on our planet. The pyramids at Giza, Stonehenge, Newgrange, Easter Island, et cetera, et cetera. I have in the book probably 14 different pages that explain these phenomenon that could not have been created by the local folks. In other words, the thing that we run into with anthropologists is that they say, well, it was the tribes on the Salisbury Plain that built Stonehenge, right? They did it with antler horns, dug holes, et cetera, et cetera. They always try to match up what they find. So my connect, to answer your question about the theory that I believe in, is I needed to prove that it all fit together to my satisfaction. And that's really, you know, what I was doing, was satisfying my own need to know. And I think the book speaks for that proof, is that the things that I bring forward and present, it's not a big book. It's, in fact, 8x11, kind of like Life magazine. You know, it's the way I purposely designed it so that it could be easy to understand. And the objects that are discussed and explained, and I've got over maybe 145 color pictures.
So do you subscribe to the similar theory of Sitchin, that this visitation occurred? Let's leave out the reasons why, because he claims that, you know, they came to mine gold and they needed it for their atmosphere. But this visitation occurred, and in so doing, the genetic engineering of us began?
Yes. In other words, if you take the Sumerian kings list and go backwards and add up all those time frames, it looks like we got colonized as a planet 450,000 years ago. That dovetails and fits with the translation of the kings list. Then, for 200,000 years, there were just them, just the Anunnaki here, and they created four or five cities that we still have the ruins of. They're digging around, and they can find these Anunnaki cities. About 250,000 years ago, or 200,000 years after they were here, they genetically engineered a creature, which was Homo erectus, into Homo sapiens, us.
Why'd they wait so long?
Probably
a couple hundred thousand years.
Well, you know, if you're doing your thing and you don't need any help, and the creatures around you, you can't communicate with them, so you don't need them, then you don't need any help.
And are they coming and going during this 200,000-year period?
During that period of time, they are transporting the gold that they needed back to their home planet to supposedly close a hole in the ozone layer. I mean, they had a hole in their atmosphere.
Nibiru.
Thank you. Nibiru. I mean, this is from Sitchin. And that the heroes that they had kind of revolted on them and got tired of going 2 miles down in the African gold mines. So the solution was to either abandon the project or create a primitive worker. And I guess that's...
Because they decided they weren't going to mine it themselves.
They were. Yeah, they were. And the guys revolted on them. That's what it says in the tablets. And there was a story there that says that the heroes, the workers in the mines...
Well, let me stop you for just a second there, Marshall. Do we have, even though we're talking about 200 to 400,000 years ago, is there any evidence which shows where these mines are that we see the mining, as primitive as it might have been?
Well, they got washed out in the flood. That was when the deluge hit.
Okay.
Those mines got wiped out, but the activity, you know, the first remains that we found of our species is in Southeast Africa. That's where they were created. They said they created them there by the mines, and hey, guess what? The bones we find of Homo sapiens, which is a new species, are in Southeast Africa. That's where they are.
Where the mines were,
right.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right, well, stay with us, Marshall. We're going to continue this fascinating discussion, and then we'll get into some of the reasons why. Well, it's the After Dark newsletter, the July issue. This is going to be a hot one indeed. So call 1-888-727-5505. Read all about the Morgus gas pill and just what's up with that. 1-888-727-5505. You can also order After Dark, where you get 14 issues for the price of 12, by going online at coasttocoastam.com. There's a secure server there, and you can pick up that subscription that way as well. And you're listening to Coast with our guest, Marshall Klarfeld. I'm George Norrie, as we talk about Adam, the missing link. Let's pick it up, Marshall, if we can, by talking about the fact then that, along with Zechariah Sitchin, the fact is that they came here. Now, I guess through technology, because we can do it now.
Right.
On some of the planets we do find, the 100-plus, we can generally tell what the gas makeup is and things like that. So I would assume they figured out that this planet, Earth, was pretty ripe for their own lifestyle and living style, right?
I can't speak to that because I don't, you know, I wasn't there. I don't know what the reasons were. But if we could, for just 1 minute, go back to the genetic engineering point that you brought up in the last segment, I'd like to add to that what I found as more evidence of the of what's going on. In fact, the Human Genome Study reported in 2001 that, you know, humans contain about 25,000 plus genes. Science Magazine reported that the human genome contains 223 genes that do not have the required precursors for the genomic evolutionary tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, George, where did those 223 genes come from?
Come from, that's right.
And if we're on the verge right now of, you know, genetically engineering humans ourselves. We've got the technology and the ability to do that. In fact, the Chinese will probably be the first ones to do it because they don't have any political restraints or financial restraints. But the fact that it shows up in our human genome study kind of makes you wonder, you know, well, isn't that where we came from? And the other point is that of all the animals on our planet, man is the only one that possesses inherent mathematical ability. Now, where did that come from? It wasn't an evolutionary thing, but it was certainly necessary to travel in space. We could not do the space explorations, the moonshot, and all that without great mathematical ability. And it didn't come by evolution. It had to come from outer space.
Okay, so this genetic altering, what did they genetically alter? The Neanderthals at the time?
No, I think what they called them creatures. And they were hairy, and our evidence anthropologically shows that they were Homo erectus. They were all over the place. And they took the egg. They wrote this. This is in the transfer.
All right, so whatever this species might have been that they...
They jump-started it.
But they're gone, I guess. There's no...
No, they're not.
They're not around
remains. We have the bones of them, and they're filled up. You know, museums, everybody knows what Homo erectus was.
Okay.
And they were all over the place. But they couldn't speak, George, and the level of their technology was two stones hitting them together.
All right, and their intelligence then was way down on,
yeah,
the,
right.
on the totem
so
pole.
All of a sudden, we appear. You know, where'd we come from?
Were we created like life-size, or did we have to evolve,
yes,
from the baby state?
No, they went from babies. What they did is they took the egg of the Homo erectus female, and they implanted the DNA from them, and then they transferred that egg into the womb of one of their female Anunnakis. So there was a birth mother. And there's an interesting sidebar to this. In other words, we're doing that sort of adoption versus babies being made. You know, we make babies and we implant dozens of eggs from...
Sure.
Okay.
In vitro.
Thank you, George. If these babies were raised by Anunnaki birth mothers,
okay,
they had to speak the language of the Anunnaki.
Right.
And I'm pretty much convinced that that language was Sumerian. because Sumerian is a very strange language. Anybody that goes to the dictionary and looks it up.
It's close to Arabic, right?
No, it's not close to anything.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the most unique languages on the planet.
All right.
It was the first language spoken.
But Sumeria is in part of modern-day Iraq right now, right?
That's where it was, yeah.
Yeah, all right.
Between the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, that's where the main civilization of the Anunnaki was, because they landed in the Persian Gulf and went up that way.
I still find it fascinating that with all that that had happened there hundreds of thousands of years ago, there we are right now battling for it.
Yes.
You know, that's got some strange overtones.
It's spooky.
Yeah.
But I wanted to bring back those two, the mathematical ability, which had to come from someplace else. It didn't evolve. There was no reason for evolution to give us the mathematical.
So you don't think, though, that the genetic altering was being done to help the planet, to create mankind? Do you agree with Sitchin that it was being done for their own purposes? They needed workers?
Yes. But there's an interesting story, and that's why I put Gilgamesh in my book. The story of Gilgamesh is the 12 tablets, and the 11th tablet is the exact story of the flood. But if you read really in depth of what happened there, how that story went, you get the understanding that one of the Anunnaki leaders, wanted to wipe us out. That was he says, there's a flood coming. He knows that's going to happen. He says, I don't want anybody. He made them all swear not to help. But the creator, Enki, got a dream messenger from the creator of all that it was his destiny to save humanity, because it was the Anunnaki's destiny to come to the planet Earth and create humans, and it's humans' responsibility or destiny to inherit the Earth. So when Enki got this message and he was told how to avoid breaking his oath and to build the ark and so forth to save humanity, he went to his son's house and he talked to the wall. And the wall was not direct conversation with anybody. Anyway, the story is fascinating to me, George, because there, again, they believe in destiny. They're saying that, okay, if it's destiny that we came here and it was our destiny to create humans, then it's our destiny to save them. And once they agreed that that was their destiny, and they helped them. And that's where this civilization blossomed. I mean, all
that's
the help that they got.
Yeah.
Was because they were told, you know, that's your destiny and this is what you're supposed to do.
Did they talk about the flood and what caused it?
Yes. Their planet, you see, their planet circles, you know.
So you believe their planet is also in our solar system, as Sitchin does?
Yes, absolutely, because there's written records of it, George. In other words, if you go back in history, and I also point that out in the book, the Sumerians called it Nibiru. The Hebrews called it celestial star.
I wish I could find an astronomer who could find it. I have tried. I've given them coordinates based on Sitchin's book.
Right.
You know, it's on this 3,600-year elliptical orbit.
Right.
And
what we can rely on, George, I think, is that the written record, the Greeks called it a Nemesis. And if it was called Nemesis, because every time it came inside close by, it passes actually between Mars and Jupiter. It causes great gravitational effects on planet Earth. Now that's how they knew there was going to be a flood. And this is the story that they told: is that the planet had warmed up, our planet Earth had warmed up, and that the Antarctic ice shelf had loosened. And that the gravitational pull on it as Nibiru came through was going to slide it into the Southern Ocean, causing a tsunami.
I see.
And the tsunami was going to wipe out everything in its path.
I see.
And the Ark, by the way, was a submarine. It's a submersible. I have a picture of it in the book with a snorkel on it. It was not an Ark that floated on top of the water, because that would have just been wiped out by the tsunami. But the survival of it was the...
So the tsunami was really what they thought the flood was.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And now they knew it was going to happen.
And it was huge.
Ooh, yeah. Big time. And the fact that they knew it and they talked about it and they wrote about it is fascinating to me. And the story of Gilgamesh tells what this was all about.
Let's go. I was going to talk a little bit about Gilgamesh next hour, but since you've brought it up, first of all, give me some highlights. Gilgamesh, what is this?
First action hero in history. It's the first recorded story ever written. It's about a king in Uruk, one of the towns in Mesopotamia.
Again, where modern-day Iraq is, right?
Exactly, all exactly. Right. And the story is filled with information. Like, there's a, my favorite goddess is this gal, Ishtar. She's really something else. And
you think.
Well, she's the goddess of love and war. I mean, she appears, by the way, in history, if you trace the lineage of this deity thing, in the Roman pantheon, she's Venus, and in the Greek, she's Aphrodite.
Okay.
And in the Egyptian, she's Isis.
She's the same person, though, right?
Same person, All right. Okay. Anyway, she comes down from above and interfaces with Gilgamesh and propositions him. She wants to take him to bed.
Now, is Gilgamesh an earthling, or is he Anunnaki?
Well, he's two-thirds. His mother was an Anunnaki princess, and his father was a human king.
Okay.
Here's the opposite. We normally had the males coming down and creating offspring with our females, but this was the reverse. It was a goddess, or Nisan was her name. And her husband was King Gilgamesh, and when he died, the son became the king, and his mother was an Anunnaki. So Gilgamesh carries two-thirds royal blood, so to speak.
Okay.
And he's kind of untouchable, you know. But
what kind of guy is he? What do they say?
Well, he wasn't a very nice king in the beginning. This is another interesting part of the story of Gilgamesh. By the way, I have a CD on my webpage that does a movie version of this. Sort of. He was taking first nuptial rites of all the brides in his city, and the people really got kind of upset with him, which you can understand. So the thing that is important is that they talked to the Anunnaki. They said, help us get this guy off our back. He's taken the first nuptial rites of all of our brides, and it's not fair. It's not nice.
So they're a little upset with him about his
avoiding
around.
Now, they create, the Anunnaki create a clone of the king, and it's called Enkidu. And the reason the name is Enkidu is because Enki was the chief genetic engineer, and he could do this. Now, I find it kind of amazing that they could clone an adult person that was just like the king. Anyway, they meet, they fight, and then they look in each other's eyes. And they see each other, and they become best buddies. And they go off adventuring. So this is where the adventure part of Gilgamesh comes
in. And I've got to ask you an off-the-wall question, only because my curiosity has now gotten me. Didn't Jimmy Durante used to sing a song called
Enki Dinky Doo?
Yeah, was it about him?
I don't know. I'm glad you brought that up, George. That's amazing. I never Enki Dinky Doo. You're right.
I mean, who would make up a name like that? So he had to have picked it from this thing.
Well, you know, Carl Sagan, in his book Contact, has a spaceship called Gilgamesh, which I thought was kind of neat. And then on the record that he put on Voyager, you know, the golden record with all the greetings, the first language of saying hello, hi, how are you, was in Sumerian.
That's fascinating,
too.
How do you
like that?
Yeah, thinking maybe they will find it. Okay, so
they could read it. I mean, it's a tough language.
They make a clone of Gilgamesh, you say,
mm-hmm.
And that's Enki Dinky Doo?
They call him Enkidu.
Okay.
Enkidu. And now he dies. I mean, there's a whole story about Ishtar comes down and she makes this proposition to Gilgamesh, and he refuses her, saying that he knows the history of all the women, of all the men that she's taken to bed and what horrible things have happened to them. So he didn't want any part of her. She gets ticked off, goes back up to the mothership, which is orbiting, and this is where you get the back and forth transportation in this story. Brings down the Bull of Heaven, which is their most powerful weapon, and starts trenching the citizens in Uruk. You know, she blows, the bull snorts, and out of his nose and mouth come this flame, which
opens. It's like a huge laser machine
something. It's a laser machine, exactly. Yeah. And, of course, Enkidu and Gilgamesh tear the thing apart, break it up, and throw her back, and she gets really mad. Now, she wants to kill them both, and her grandfather says, no, he's the leader, by the way, Anu. You can't do that. He's part of us. You can do what you want to Enkidu. So she kills Enkidu in a horrible way, and Gilgamesh gets very upset seeing his friend die. And this is where the story takes on its most interesting aspect.
And this is all documented.
It's all documented.
All right, go ahead.
Story. He wants to become immortal. He says, I don't want to die. I'm two-thirds royal. Why should I die? And so the story goes on in his pursuit of immortality, and he finally ends up meeting with his great uncle, who is Noah from the Bible. And Noah has been granted long life because he saves humanity.
And what is Noah's genetic makeup?
He's human, but he's been somehow altered to have long life. He
all
lives
right.
for a very long
okay,
time.
Okay, but he's all human.
Yeah, but okay. He tells, in the 11th tablet, which I feature in the book, he tells the story that has never been told, the secret that was kept from humanity. And that's the story I told you, that you know that's how it comes forward in Gilgamesh, is that there was a secret meeting of the leaders, and they were all sworn to this oath of not helping when the flood came, and let them all die. In fact, interesting comment in one of the translations I read, that Enlil, who was the boss, said, you know, they're too noisy. And he said, they're intermarrying with our people, and they're diluting our bloodline. Let's get rid of them all.
They just got jealous of us, maybe?
Well, I don't know if it was jealousy, but just he got ticked off that we were noisy, we were populating all over the place, and that his people, the Anunnaki, were creating hybrids.
So they think they made a monsters with us, I guess, huh?
Well, the big question is that he turned around, he did 180, and he decided when the message came through his brothers.
At what time period would this be, do you think?
Okay, so the story, as near as I could figure out, is about 5,900 years old when it got written down. Now, it was written on these 12 tablets in Sumerian, and then it got translated into Babylonian and Akkadian, and, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years of this thing. But I'm pretty sure that, like most stories, George, it was oral first.
Yes.
You know, most of this, like,
years, hundreds of years, maybe thousands.
Before it was ever written down, right. Anyway, it's fascinating. I put it on a CD.
And they talk, though, Marshall, about, you know, the beans coming down from above and things like that with the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Yes, in fact, that's what's fascinating. If you read the story in the light of how we understand things today, up above was the orbiting mothership.
Now, who would make that up as a storyteller, for example? They just wouldn't do that, would they?
No, I don't think so, George. I think it was one of these stories that was purposely constructed to transfer information so that we would understand it later on. That's my take on it, George.
Okay, now they know about the tsunami. They know it's going to occur. They don't
right.
want to tip us off. Enki, I guess, tips off Noah. What does Noah actually do? How many people does he round up? Is it just his family? I mean, are those accounts in the Bible accurate?
They're pretty close to what the story on the Gilgamesh side is. What they said they did. Well, he collected his family and his friends and his animals and put them into this submarine. But Enki and his sister went around and picked up the DNA from every other living thing and put it in a gold box and stuck it in.
Okay. So they might not necessarily have had every animal on this planet, but they probably had some kind of DNA.
Right.
Hair,
right.
Something.
Everything. Yep.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Right. As I was trying to figure out, how are you going to put all these animals on an R? And it just, even in my little brain at the time, a long time ago as a kid, it didn't compute.
No. I think, you know, and it's an interesting, that even the number of birds that were released and everything that's in this story of Gilgamesh's flood, the 11th tablet, is a mirror image of the Bible story.
When we come back, Marshall, I want to get into the Egyptian pyramids. I want to talk with you about some things going on in Peru, the Nazca Lines, and some other really strong thoughts on ET visitations as well. With your theory, of course, backing up Zechariah Sitchin, that mankind was genetically altered 250,000 years ago. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.